the Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 8th, and sadly, and I apologize to the committee, we talked about this a little bit up here, not in groups of three, but in groups of two, that it is confusing that we have a number of work sessions. We're waiting for a number of amendments to come back and make sure that everybody is okay with them. We are very close on most of them, but we are actually waiting for the language to be sure the language does what all the parties agreed that they wanted the language to do. So, today's Wednesday, so I'm not going to carry any of them over. We could still reschedule as late as Friday for Monday, right?
Yes.
Okay. So we're not going to carry them over. That does not mean these bills are dead. All of these bills are moving. They're all moving forward, but not today. So, do I have to do anything with this?
Just say reschedule all of the bills.
Reschedule all the bills. Okay.
Work session bills.
Work session bills.
Okay. Yeah. Everybody go home. All right, I am going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 834.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 834 requires the Department of Human Services to develop a proposal for the creation of a Human Rights Commission. It requires the department to report findings and proposal and submit the proposal to the Legislative Assembly by September 1st, 2017. It declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Thanks. And we have Janie, Dano, Gabrielle, and Katie Rose. Lilia, did you want to say anything, or do you prefer to?
I'm here for questions.
Excellent.
Testing. Is that on?
Yes, okay. It is. And you don't have to get too close.
Okay.
Because it's pretty,
how's that?
Pretty powerful.
I have a soft
Perfect.
Voice.
Perfect.
Okay. Chair Gelser and members of the committee, my name is Jamie Danio, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. The council represents Oregonians with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their family members. 60% of our membership is made up of this population. We also have members who represent state agencies and community partners that receive funding on behalf of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And together, our charge is to advance social and policy change so that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families and communities can live, work, and play and learn together. So the council is federally mandated to assure that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families have access to services and supports that help them have great lives in the community, that help them support them to be independent and have choice and control over what happens in their lives and contribute to community as the rest of us do, other Oregonians without disabilities. So we believe that communities are strongest when everyone is afforded dignity and basic human rights to live and work as they choose in their communities. For people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, it's critical that dignity and basic human rights are also upheld and protected in the services and supports that they receive. So by service systems and also by the people that provide direct supports. We're excited for the opportunity to support Senate Bill 834, which directs the Department of Human Services to create a Human Services Commission that's independent, and the commission will make sure that the rights and dignity of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are protected and respected in their services and in their individual service plans. So on a similar note, we have embraced the federal home and community-based services rules. These are rules that ensure that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are supported to be members of their communities and enjoy basic freedoms like everyone else in ways that they choose. The HCBS was enacted at the federal level in 2014 to ensure that basic freedoms that all people experience basic freedoms in the community and that these freedoms are honored in their services. So such freedoms include when a person can visit with friends or family, either in their homes or in the community, when people choose to get up in the morning or take a shower, and what they want to do for fun, scheduling, managing their own schedules, and deciding when to go to bed at night. We know that when we're all happier and healthier when these freedoms are respected and honored in our personal lives. And we know that when these freedoms are denied or removed, people are less satisfied and happy with their lives, which unnecessarily has a negative impact on health and well-being. We also know that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and all of us really, are most successful when we have choice and control over our own lives. We're aware that basic freedoms, like those I just described, can be removed from or restricted in a person's support plan for various reasons. And as such, we believe a Human Rights Commission would be an invaluable tool to ensure that such restrictions do not last longer than necessary, that other less restrictive alternatives are tried, and that the person is given informed choice about the restriction. Although not part of the bill, we hope that the Human Rights Commission would have a voting majority of families and self-advocates. These people are closest to the services. They're also experts on services and how they impact people's lives, and their voice is critical to any discussions about rights. We also hope that the commission would have the ability to hire its own professional experts so that members receive the highest quality and most impartial information. Oregon is strongest when all members of its communities are treated with dignity and respect. People with intellectual and developmental disabilities deserve to experience basic freedoms like other Oregonians without disabilities. An independent Human Rights Commission would ensure that their basic human rights are honored and protected by systems and supports around them. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you, Jeannie.
Welcome.
Chair Gelser and committee. I'm Gabrielle Gadon. I am the executive director of Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition. Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition is made up of 18 groups throughout Oregon who advocate from everything from healthcare to employment to coming to the state capitol to talk to representatives and legislators on bills that might impact people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I will be having Jamie assist me by asking me questions and answering them.
Okay, Gabby, the mission of the Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition is to bring self-advocates together to have a unified voice about issues that affect their lives. What does that mean to you and your members?
It means that we're able to come together to speak on topics from employment to healthcare to bills and people's rights. We come together to be able to speak for ourselves, but others as well is what we really look at.
So when are self-advocates most successful with their supports?
When they have enough support to be able to be independent and to learn the skills from just being able to get up in the morning, go to your job, to just being able to eat healthy. It can really go from just basic things in life, which this bill really represents, is giving them the freedom to be able to choose.
Some freedoms are really basic, like choosing when you eat lunch and when you shower. Why do these things matter?
Because everyone wants to be able to take a shower when they want and go eat when they want. Because it's just a human right. We all want to have the privilege of being able to be ourselves and be independent and to think our own way and to be our own way. There are many situations that someone might not be getting this, which would be if the home was restricting when they were to eat, and that you wouldn't want that. None of you up there would want that. None of us would want it. So why really put this on someone that can't say no? Why put this rule on something that is impossible?
Why is it important to have a commission to review when people's rights are limited?
To be able to fix the problems in the system that are making it this possible that they're being restricted from doing activities that everybody wants to be able to choose to do when they want to be able to do them. To make it so they can be independent individuals and to be able to grow into members of society.
How do you envision having DHS work with the Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition to create this proposal?
We would like them to be able to come to our executive and our in-person board meetings, as well as allow us to send out surveys to all our advocacy groups and all the advocacy community.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I want to say thank you for the privilege of coming here and testifying. This is a very exciting time in our history to be able to stand up and be able to fight for the rights of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
And Gabrielle, could I ask you a couple questions too?
Yes.
So have you, in the work that you do as an advocate with other adults that experience intellectual and developmental disabilities, have you met people that have maybe been told they have to take a shower when they don't want to take a shower?
We have many members of OSAC, that Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition, that actually have had that experience and are still having that experience. It's a very crippling situation because they feel less than.
And what about, have you ever talked with anybody that is an adult that has been restricted or told who they can be friends with or who they can date?
It happens quite often. I've been in this community since I was young because I am someone with an intellectual and developmental disability. So really listening to these stories, even as a teenager, they were really restricted to the point that it was ridiculous.
And so have you met anybody that is an adult, so not a teenager anymore, but an adult,
yeah,
that has been told by their guardian or their group home or their supported living staff that there are certain things you're not allowed to watch on TV or that you aren't allowed to use the internet? Have you met people that have had those experiences?
Yes, I have met a lot of people through Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition that have had those experiences and are still living those experiences. Some have been able to get out, but a lot of them can't.
And do you think that they know that the federal law guarantees those rights to them as adults and that they would know how to get help to be able to make their own choices every day right now?
So there's a lot of people that don't know those are their rights. They are just told it's this way, you can't change it. It's not your choice, no matter if they're 21, 18, up to 65, they're still being told, it's just this way, you're going to have to get over it, basically.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions for Gabrielle? Senator Dimbrough, you have
your
question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And just following up on the questions that the chair asked, the people who are restricting the decisions, are those the person's guardian or the people who run the group home that they live in? Who is it that's restricting their decisions?
I've heard everything from people that work for DD Services saying that it has to be this way, has to be that way, to the guardians, to the group homes. It varies, and it's not always with all group homes or all DD services. It just happens in our system like everything else does. So it's a variety.
And I know that the language in the bill and the preamble, I would really like to change at the beginning. It, like in line 3, it says, whereas service providers, I think that really needs to be expanded to say, whereas service providers, parents, guardians, and other support people may.
I feel that you really should change that part because it doesn't just go with DD services. It's not just we're targeting one situation with one group of people. We're targeting everything. So really teaching the parents or the guardians the rights of the individual and giving them they might not even know what they're doing by restricting them, just giving them the knowledge to be able to say, oh, okay, and step back. Oh, I'm doing this wrong. This person has rights just like everyone else. It's going to be pretty big because it starts off with the parents and kind of extends out to the rest of the system.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions for Gabrielle? No, thank you very much. Katie.
Thank you. Chair Gelson, members of the committee, my name is Katie Rose, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Coalition today. We are a group of more than 30 organizations across Oregon that are committed to equality, community integration, and quality services for people living in our all across Oregon with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I am also the executive director of the Oregon Support Services Association. We're an association of the 14 brokerages across Oregon that serve just under 8,000 adults living in their own or family homes across Oregon as well. So we already talked about Oregon's values. We strongly believe that Oregon is strongest when people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are able to live in their own communities and participate in those. We heard a little bit from Jamie about the home and community-based services, the HCBS regulations that are federally mandated, and those are rules that the coalition has worked as stakeholders very in an engaged fashion with DHS to implement and work on fine-tuning. Those rules are really an opportunity for us to walk our values. These are values that Oregon committed to a long time ago, and we see them as a really positive step to be able to affirm and really make sure that everyone is adhering to these rules. The Human Rights Commission that is proposed under this bill would help us to meet the HCBS standards, but really more importantly, it would respect the dignity of people with IDD who are living in the community and who, really deserve to live in the least restrictive environment that they possibly can. My hand is trembling.
You're doing great.
Human Rights Commissions, and they were committees at that point, are a part of Oregon's history when we lived in, when we had institutions, both the Fairview Training Center and the Eastern Oregon Training Center. And they were really a mechanism to protect people and to protect their basic human rights in a system that was inhumane. Many people continue, as Gabby mentioned, continue to live with their rights restricted at this point, and those rights are restricted for a variety of reasons and in a variety of situations, both well-intentioned and not. Those folks and everyone really deserves to be protected by an independent oversight committee. The establishment of a Human Rights Commission is consistent with the implementation of federal HCBS regulations and also the values that we profess as Oregonians. So we urge you to support free and unrestricted lives for Oregonians with intellectual and developmental disabilities by passing Senate Bill 834. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. Any questions for this panel? Great. Thank you all very much. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 834? All right. So with that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 834. And So Senator Olson isn't here.
No. He said he was going home.
Oh, he went home? Okay. Would somebody take the gavel?
Sure.
Because the next ones are mine. All right. There's three of them, and they're all different.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 265.
Oh, this is your bill, too.
Well, then you better do a good job.
All right, I'll do my best.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 265 requires the Department of Human Services to conduct monthly in-person visits with child or ward in substitute care, including a review of academic status and supports. It directs DHS to conduct exit interviews with the child or ward prior to removing them from substitute care placements. It requires DHS to ensure school placement of a child or ward is not more restrictive than the resident school district of the child, nor in a self-contained classroom. It requires DHS to allow the child or ward the opportunity to create a facilitated person-centered plan before leaving substitute care.
Okay, Senator Gelser, welcome.
Thank you, Senator Dimbro, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, Corvallis, Albany, Philomath, Millersburg, Tangent, and the unincorporated areas in that region. So I'm happy to bring to you today Senate Bill 265. And before I talk to you about the bill, this is also the first chance that I have gotten to sit at a table in front of the legislature with Lena Al-Husseini, who is our new child welfare director. I continue to be so grateful that she was willing to take a risk on us and come to Oregon. I think, as we all know, we face a lot of challenges in our child welfare system. And what we have in Lena is a person who is passionate, committed, and has a long track record of innovation and really looking for creative new ways to care for kids. So I'm just really, really feel fortunate to get to sit here with her today and know that we have a lot of hard work ahead, but just wanted to commend her to all of you. So Senate Bill 265 still needs some work, and I'm really looking forward to working with the department to get it right. I'd like to talk with you about what the general idea behind it is. As you know, in this committee, we've spent a lot of time talking about the safety of kids in care and the experience that they've had in care. And in that process, over the last almost 2 years, I've spent a lot of time meeting with and talking to foster youth. And one of the things that I've come to understand, and we've heard it from the youth when they've come before our committees as part of the Oregon Foster Youth Coalition, is this idea of well-being, and well-being being something more than safety. When you become a ward of the state, we, the state of Oregon, become that child's parent. And if any of us think about the children that we've raised at home or that we're raising at home, we do more for them every day than give them food and a place to sleep. We look at their basic foundations as a human, and we work on building their capacity to be successful as adults. So this bill, kind of going from top to bottom, really tries to get at a couple of those pieces by strengthening the relationship with the caseworker and some of the protections for kids. The first piece really calls out a little bit more the work around school for the kids, which really should be a collaboration between the department and the school districts, but really making sure that our students that are in foster care are on track to graduate from high school and that they're attending school. One of the things that we found in working in the child caring agency space, Give Us This Day, some of these other situations, kids weren't going to school at all. And that is a problem. That's not necessarily abuse, but that is something that we should be working at. The second piece, which is in subsection 2, is one of the pieces that's the piece that's most important to me in the bill. In the interim, when we worked with Public Knowledge, who was the independent reviewer that came to look at safety of kids in care, one of the ideas that came out of this was that youth were telling us that it's very hard to speak up and say that you're having a problem in your foster home when you're placed there, because you're worried about, will that displace you? Will you have to move? And it's even worse if you're placed with a sibling. Would that mean that you might be separated from your sibling? So expecting a child to speak up about things, again, that don't necessarily rise to the level of abuse, but they're the things we've heard about in this committee, like a child being told that they have to eat in the kitchen while the rest of the family eats in the dining room, or being forced to attend religious services that are different than that child's religion. We need to know those things. So what the bill would intend to do, and this is consistent with one of the recommendations that came out of Public Knowledge, is that we do an exit interview with kids when they are leaving a placement. And Kevin and Lena pointed out today, really good point, the way this language is here, it doesn't work. It doesn't need to happen prior to the removal or the move, but in close proximity to that. And the idea would be, it's not just a gotcha thing, it's also identifying what are the really great strengths of this placement. And having this information come back from the youth who are living in these foster homes would better help the agency understand the strengths and the types of kids that families match best with. And kids are going to be better able to provide that information than anybody else. The next piece, it has to do with when children and youth are moved from one school district to another school district, ensuring that the student's IEP is still followed, so that if you have a student, for instance, that was included, a student with Down syndrome was included in a regular third grade classroom in the Corvallis School District, that if that child was moved to the Portland School District, he wasn't just automatically put in a self-contained classroom, that he would get to continue that same experience that he had had in a non-restrictive setting, or if he was accessing physical therapy or occupational therapy when this child is moving, and it's consistent with the federal law that says the IEP has to be consistent across districts, but this would give the department and the folks when they're doing the planning the ability to point to this and say, yes, you have to comply with the kid's IEP. And the last piece, section two, is really more of a discussion point, and I would imagine working with the department to kind of direct this more as a how do we look into doing this. But in the intellectual disability world, we do something that's called a facilitated person-centered plan. And we had the opportunity to do this in my family for my son when he was aging out of school. And what you do is you bring together people in the individual's life that know the person well from a variety of different areas. And it's very graphic. You have big pictures up on the wall. And you're identifying the individual's strengths and beliefs and hopes and fears of that individual youth, and you identify the goals and who can help them. And what's really beautiful about it is it's true in both the IDD system and in foster care. People have a lot of people in their lives that are in their lives because they're paid to be there. And what you do through this person-centered planning process is start to figure out who are these natural supports that you can count on even when your placement changes. And it's a very it's a very uplifting and encouraging and inspiring activity for young people. So we aspire to do part of this in our independent living program. This would just make it a little bit more robust and really help the youth know not just what the paid and formal resources are, but what are some of the informal resources and what are the things about you that are really extraordinary. Because if you think about these kids that are moving around a lot, I don't know about all of you with your kids, but I try to find at least 5 times a day for each of my 4 kids where I tell them something that I really appreciate about them. All kids should have that, and this is an opportunity that we could take to do this for our foster youth. So that is the bill as it's written, as what it's intended to do. I would imagine scaling it back if we move forward with it, with the primary focus being on those exit interviews.
Thank you. Senator Gelser, Senator Dambro, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lina Al-Husseini, Director of Child Welfare, and thank you for your very kind comments. Truly humbled. I feel very honored to be here and to have the opportunity to work with you, my colleagues at DHS, the legislature, and all the communities of Oregon to serve Oregon's children. I think they deserve our attention, and I'm looking forward to really investing time and effort to get all of us to work with for their benefit. Regarding Senate Bill 265, we're aligned with Senator Gelser's intent. We're just working on tweaking some of the language to make sure that it addresses your intention to provide for the children, and we will come back, I hope, with a different language that we're both very comfortable with. So thank you.
Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you for bringing this forward, Senator Gelser. The first question is how many children or wards of the state do we have?
In total?
Yes.
In total, at the moment, it's around 7,500. It changes. You know, it's a live number, but it's around that much.
Okay.
At any one time.
And there's a key piece of information I forgot to mention. Already, this is kind of tagged to what is already happening. So there's a required face-to-face visit with each of these children every month. So
right.
In this section one where it talks about monthly, these questions would be built into that monthly visit that's already happening between the caseworker and
okay.
the child.
And that's what I wanted. My next question was, do we have case managers who can give the time to all of these things?
Well, we currently have monthly face-to-face contact with all the children. We just do it with all the children. We're not just limited to over 5-year-olds. So my understanding, we already do this.
Okay. So
and it's all our children in
okay.
our care. So.
And then the other question, if when there are parents involved, as a parent, I don't like the government to tell me how to raise my child. And there are a lot of different ways to raise your child. child, and maybe the way I raise my child is not maybe the same as, say, you raise your children. So I know in my mind what I think is the right way, but I want to make sure that we're not going to infringe on a parent's rights on how they, you know, for instance, I know a mother who will want to have her child take a bath every day, and there are teenagers who need a bath every day, but then other parents don't care if they're child goes a week without taking a shower or a bath. I mean, when we start getting specific about, you know, what is a good parent, that's I have concerns about that.
So, Chair Dembrough, Senator Montes Anderson. So this is a different bill than the
other. I know. I'm sort of blending them.
Yeah. So so this doesn't say anything about showering, and that
yes.
bill was about adults, not about kids. But this is only about children in foster care, and it really doesn't go to the specific care of the kids beyond what already is outlined in contract and certification for foster care. It wouldn't change anything about the day-to-day care of kids. It's creating the three things that it does is making sure somebody knows is the kid on track to graduate from high school and that it's tracked, that we're doing an exit interview when the kid leaves to say, hey, how was this placement for you? How did that work out for you? What worked well? What didn't? And then kind of supporting that kid with a plan. It's not, it would not be telling any parent how to do anything. And these children are not in their parents' home. This is restricted to kids in foster care.
Okay. Then just a follow-up then in Section 2, when the child or ward shall be allowed to invite any individual to the process requiring a person-centered plan, too. And again, I don't know enough about the children, but sometimes, and maybe this doesn't happen in the intellectual disabled population, but some of the friends aren't necessarily the friends that parents would like to have at the table. I don't know if that will occur, but, you know, I don't know if that'll be effective, but I assume that if it doesn't work, we would address that again. But
Chair Dembrough, Senator Montes Anderson, again, in Section 2, that is, it's intended, and we can double check to make sure that the language is right. It's intended to be kids that are in care. So again, you're not talking about the children's parents are infringing on their rights. The language here is for these plans to work really well. It could be their siblings that might be in a different placement that they want to have there. It very well could be their parents that they would like their biological parents to be at this safe place. Obviously, there probably would be some rules around safety plans and some of those other issues, and we can work on the language to make sure that is the case. But I think especially for youth, and this again would be kids that are 16 or older, youth that are 16 or older, the people that young people that have moved through foster care, if they have been in foster care for a time, the people in their life that are important to them might be in different places and unknown to other people, and this is an opportunity to start to pull some of those threads together and in a way that's not always possible for them to provide some sense of continuity.
Well, if it works, great. I'm just, the implementation seems maybe a little overwhelming. All of these things that we have to do, ideally fine. And it's, I mean, even parents have a hard time doing some of this that is being put forward here. In fact, there's a lot of neglect. They leave it up to the parent, and the parent certainly doesn't do all of these. I mean, we know that. So I don't know. I think it's a happy balance, but if DHS says they can do it, we're putting a whole lot on their plate.
Well, Chair Dembrough, Senator Montes Anderson, We're going to look at the language and make sure it's doable. So this is not the final version of. We're going to work together to make sure that we can, you know, really address the intent of the bill in a realistic way that's inclusive. So,
And I think one of the points that you bring up, and I would never lose the opportunity to do this, and you should take this as an invitation to follow up and use your strong word.
Okay.
But we have phenomenal caseworkers in the Department of Human Services who are working incredibly hard. Our workload model is currently at 83%. So when we get frustrated when we read articles in the newspaper about what is not going right with child welfare, whether it's a child in care or a child that hasn't been taken into care, we have to go back and think about, if you look at the work of child welfare, what 17% of the work are we okay with not getting done? And that assumes that all of those positions are filled at that 83% that's funded. I met with some child welfare workers the other day that said in their office they feel like they're at closer to 60% of the workload model because the work is so hard that they're leaving. We're losing the workers. We have inadequate experience that's there. We were in a meeting the other day, and one of the CPS workers talked about people, and there are people crying in his office every day because this work is so hard and so overwhelming. So I want us to be able to do these things for these kids. I think if we take responsibility and we bring kids into the care of the state and we've separated them from their family, we have a very serious obligation to care for and support them. I don't think we can do any of that until we appropriately fund and build up the very foundation of our system, which is our caseworkers, our screeners, and our CPS workers. And that's something that I think that we have a moral imperative to deal with in ways and means. And when we have that number of people, these things are going to come naturally because people go into the work to care for the kids. And I know Lena has a good word that she uses to describe.
Chair Dumbro, Senator Moniz Anderson, the word I use usually is our district offices are hemorrhaging because we don't have enough staff on the ground, and there's a huge need. And we have to look at the system from when the child is standing outside our door, and we have to be able to address all the child's needs and the family. So at the moment, just looking at our field level, and we have a lot of needs. And for Senate Bill 265, we're also hoping to to look at what the Department of Education can bring to this as well. It's not just us. So hopefully, when we all sit together on the table, and look at this bill and work it together, hopefully we can bring something of value.
So. One final comment.
Sure.
I'm a retired public health nurse, and when I had a caseload, and it seems like I never had enough time. And for one day, I could easily see 4 patients a day, because then the next the rest of the day, I'd have to do all of the charting. And when we're requiring all of this, and it all has to be documented, unless we have a really streamlined database, one omission hopefully wouldn't be a liability to the caseworker. There's just a whole lot to think about.
Chair Dumbro, Senator Moniz Anderson. I mean, the areas, I can go through some of the things we've discussed, Senator Gelser, which is, I've mentioned already the monthly in-person contact, which we're already doing, but we're doing it for all children, not just over 5. We're going to work with the Department of Education, hopefully see that we're not in conflict with their educational statutes, make sure that we're aligned. Conducting an exit interview of a child is an excellent idea, but we just want to make sure that we don't have to do it prior. We just want to make sure that we can come in and intervene if the child is at risk in any form. And we want to be able to develop a child-centered plan, and that's not in conflict with the department's effort toward the comprehensive transitional plan. So we're going to look at both statutes and try to sort of marry them together and see what we can come up with. And then we can learn a lot from the developmental disability models of care, especially their facilitated planning. So that's something we can aim for. So I'm really looking forward to working with Senator Gelser on doing this, because I think there's a lot of ideas of merit, and I'm hoping we can find a way that we can do it in a realistic and very thoughtful way. So
thank you.
Great. Okay, I have a couple of questions, just kind of informational sorts of things. Going back to the facilitated person-centered plan, so this is something that exists now for kids with disabilities, right? But not necessarily, and there may be some overlap already for kids who are in care. But so what you're proposing would be to take that model and extend it to the kid who's transitioning out then.
Correct.
And so is 16 the right age for that, or don't kids tend to transition out more like 18, or what?
So Chair Dimbrough and members of the committee, the in the IDD system, we start to look at transition really starting at about age 14, because that's the point where you're looking at what is it that you're doing in high school, what is it that you're doing in terms of job development skills, how are you preparing to be ready to move forward. So if you're thinking about just, you know, I have at home right now a 15-year-old, should be 16 in a few days, 17-year-old and 19-year-old. As they look at turning 18 years old, they have a lot of support around them, but it's still really scary. They have a lot of decisions that they have to make. They have a lot more responsibility that they take on. Imagine then a foster youth that is going to age out of care, all that rests on her shoulders as she leaves at 18. So by starting at 16, it gives that opportunity to start building those skills and that planning and that looking forward, so that it's not just happy birthday, goodbye. And nobody wants to do that. I'm not suggesting that anybody's doing that because they want to do that. But when you're in a system that's stressed and overloaded and has a lack of placements, we do have a number of 18-year-olds, and we've changed the statutes in recent years to be able to serve some kids up through the age of 21. But that 18th birthday is a pretty serious point of crisis for a lot of these young people. The other piece is the planning for college. Yeah. We've worked really hard to make tuition available to foster youth. You've got a couple of bills that are over in education right now. As I have talked to a number of foster youth and talked to some of the kids in the residential programs that have been in the other issue, they haven't known that those things are available to them. That information just has never, mm-hmm. never come to them, and it's a tremendous opportunity that they're losing. So that's
yes. Well, that's my thinking as well. Is this could be a real opportunity for. And maybe even including some former foster youth in those conversations as well to help guide them to different opportunities that are available to them as they're trying to chart their exit.
Yeah. Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, may I ask Kevin George, who is the director of foster care, and he can, I think, give also more context to some of these questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Kevin.
Good afternoon. For the record, Kevin George, Foster Care and Youth Transition Manager at Department of Human Services. Thank you, and actually these ladies are doing a tremendous job of answering the questions. I'm very impressed myself. The only other thing I think I would add is that actually we look at a younger age group. Really at age 14, we start looking at transition, as Senator Gelser talked about. And really what we brought to her was talking about how do we start collapsing some of these plans, because we're filled with plans on kids and families, and how do we collapse those into one comprehensive approach? The legislature passed about 10 years ago a requirement for us to start developing comprehensive transition plans for youth over age 16. Talks about a plan for housing, education, community connectedness, supportive caring adults, health care, and employment. So we're doing some of that now for these young people as they do that work. This just actually can be combined together, and we say, let's develop a plan and really maybe learn from the development disability world around the child-centered planning and say that might be the model to get to what we want here anyway. Now, that certainly is a model of facilitated, and that what doesn't add on to the caseworker's responsibility, and I really appreciate that insight, because caseworkers are doing a plethora of other activities, and to then try to have the skill sets available to do a objective, facilitated child-centered case plan is really challenging to do. You need somebody skilled to do that. So we'll have to look at how we get up to a model where a caseworker and all the kids show up together and the kids and the families show up together to really provide that. And really, we do currently allow young people now, when we start talking about these plans, to bring who are your support people, who's your caring, committed adults that can be around you. So it may be that they bring a friend that may be a little bit on the fringe, and that might be okay, because it might be then for the rest of the people around them to understand they're going to need a little bit more support if this is how some of the friendships are established right now. And so that's part of what we need to do, is to say, where are you at, where are we going to go together, and how do we support you to get there?
That's great. I have one last question, and that's around this idea of children being placed in classrooms self-contained classrooms with only children of similar substitute care placement circumstances. So is that actually happening?
Chair Dembrough, yes. So we've had, there's actually a bill about it this session. So in Newburgh, for instance, there's a bill from Newburgh asking to be paid back for a classroom that they opened that served only kids in a substitute care setting. There was a similar issue in Burns where the students had very similar educational needs to other kids, but they were put alone only with other foster youth in the basement of the high school and received less hours of instruction than any of the other students in the school. I talked with a family, I think it was last fall, because I talked with Cynthia, so it was after Cynthia started, it's been recently, where the child was a younger child. I think the child was like 7 or 8 years old and had bounced placements, had this really great placement. The parents went to enroll him in school in Duffer, and the school district said, sorry, we can't serve a child like that. So we can only offer him an hour of home instruction a day. So this goes back to that other issue that we heard the other day. So they moved his placement again to someplace else where the school would enroll him. So this language, again, is really not, it's not targeted at DHS. It's really targeted back at the education system around these kids are moving into your district like any other student. And just as a student that was to move in with their family, you have to be prepared to serve and welcome them. And we really don't need to be targeting kids into self-contained classrooms. I think the other place, none of you are on the education committee with me, but we had a hearing a couple of weeks ago on threat assessment in schools, and it was pretty alarming because the Marion County Threat Assessment Team talked about one of the risks for assessment was being in foster care, and that these kids were very risky because their behavior was so bad that they landed in foster care. That's one of the most devastating, inaccurate, and offensive stereotypes that I can imagine of foster youth, but that really does impact the way that youth are dealt with when they come into school and they need a little bit more protection. Caseworkers and classes, I believe, need something a little bit stronger in statute to point to when they're advocating for the kids.
Mm-hmm. So is that other bill that is addressing this practice, is that coming here, or is it going to the education committee?
The other bill isn't addressing the practice. The other bill is the Newburgh School District wants to be reimbursed for the separate classroom that they established that they no longer need because the program closed down.
And what is their justification for that practice? I mean, I find it shocking, frankly.
I could not speak for somebody else.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, are there any other questions for the panel on this bill? Okay. See none. It sounds like there's going to be more work done on the language. Great. So I'll close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 265 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 749. And I have Lena and Kevin signed up and Senator Gelser. Can you lead us off after we hear what this bill does?
All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 749 permits a child, ward, youth, or youth offender who is age 12 or older and in custody of the Department of Human Services to receive a new assignment of a caseworker upon request. It permits such children who are age 14 or older and in the legal custody of DHS to be provided access to confidential information upon request and to be allowed to sign for their own release of information. It specifies when those children must be provided with information regarding their rights under the bill.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For your record, I'm still Sarah Gelser from Senate District 8. So like the other bill, this bill also needs some work, so I would prefer to tell you what it intends to do rather than what the words on the paper say, if that is all right. The idea is that when a youth is in the care of the state, and now we are talking about youth, we're not talking about kids, we're talking about 12-year-olds and older, their primary contact for their well-being is their caseworker. Sometimes a conflict arises between a caseworker and a youth. They're not getting along. The youth has difficulty getting in touch with or communicating with that caseworker. And what the bill intends to do is to assure that the youth knows how to access help in that situation so that they can either change caseworker or have some sort of a mediation or come up with a better communication plan with that individual. The intent would not be that a youth could change their caseworker anytime they wanted. That doesn't make sense because a caseworker works with multiple people, and we frankly don't have a lot of caseworkers. But the youth really do need to have some sort of a system where the agency is accountable for basically the customer service to the young person. The second part of the bill, and I realized after we met today, thank you for leaving those materials there. I made an error in the drafting of the bill where it says 14 years of age. It should be 15 years of age. But 15 years of age is the age at which you are responsible for your own medical records. You can make your own medical decisions. And that we've had in our office young people come and ask for help and information, but they are not allowed to sign their own release of information about their own case. So they would have to go and get that release of information signed by multiple different parties with whom, frankly, they're in an adversarial situation. That are not allowing them to access that information to have an attorney or a legislator or an advocate help them. So this would just say that young person at 15 years or older would be able to sign their own release. The intent would be it would be the same type of information. So for instance, all of us, when we're helping people with DHS work, we will have them sign a release, and then we're able to get a limited set of information to assist that constituent. I assume everybody here has done that. This would be the same thing, but the youth would be able to sign. We talked today, I think it would be very important to make it clear that we're not talking about releasing to the individual confidential information about other people, siblings, the parents. It wouldn't be confidential medical information about other people. We did talk a little bit about the developmental ability of a youth to be able to access the information. I had a little bit of a different take on that, that the youth actually already has that right, so they could go, let's say they had a forensic exam at a child abuse assessment center. They already have the right as 15-year-olds to access their own medical records. And in this case, for these kids, I think it is important for them to be able to control their own information about themselves when they are seeking help.
Question on that, and this has to. I would agree. I would think they should be able to access their information. I would like to know those with mental illnesses. If you have a mental disorder, is there a problem in accessing your own information, say, if you're at the Oregon State Hospital or in a psychiatric unit? I was just wondering, are our laws going to be consistent with laws elsewhere, and I don't know what the laws are.
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, I do believe if you're a patient at the state hospital, you have the right to access your own medical information. I mean, I think that, and I could, a case in point, we had a report, it was several years ago, that came into our office that somebody indicated to my staff that he planned to murder his baby and his wife and cut them up within the next 2 hours. We decided that hit the threshold of a mandatory child abuse report. So we made the report, and a few weeks later, we were in a meeting in a coffee shop, and we had a meeting with somebody that just said they wanted to talk about mental health and law enforcement, and it turned out this person had our names as the people that had made the report. And the reason for that was it had turned into a criminal case, and then the hospital, it was in all the medical records. So he had all of the medical records, and my name and my staff's name were in the medical records because that was part of the information for the report. But certainly he had access to all of those medical records.
Okay. Should I?
Yes. And let me just, can I just ask, and following up, so, you know, you said that some of this is, you know, these are rights that the individual already has. So the difference here in the bill, as you're intending it, is to, you know, have clarification for DHS when it's a person who's under DHS supervision.
Senator Dimbro, yes, the intent here would be to get at those DHS the DHS records, the same kinds of records that you're able to get, or the information that you're able to get when you get that waiver. It really is the ability for your advocate to be able to have the conversation with the department about what's happening in your case.
Thank you. Lena?
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ina Al-Husseini. Again, we're aligned with Senator Gelser, and we've already discussed how we can sort of address the intent of the bill. Our concern is that the child gets stability. Sometimes we don't want the children to be exploited. Let's say someone wants to exploit the child and keeps letting, keep changing your caseworkers. So in a way, that's detrimental to the child. So we want to make sure the children are heard, but that they have stability with their caseworkers if appropriate. There's oversight that they have a caring, well-trained, supportive caseworkers, and there's a voice, like somebody hears if it's not a good fit. But we want to also ensure, on the other hand, there's stability, there's engagement of the whole family structure, there's a whole safety and support network for the child, and there's a plan in place. So we're going to be working, we're looking forward to be working with Senator Gelser on framing it in a way that addresses her concern and allows children over 15 to access their records in a way that doesn't re-traumatize them as well, and is very thoughtful of others' confidentiality as well. So we're hoping to strike the middle ground there. So, and Kevin, if you have something to add.
Yes, Kevin George, members of the committee. I guess the only things I would add, and that's kind of where we're both on the same page, but maybe just, different parts on the page. It is about, because I, as a former caseworker 100 years ago, spent some of those times sitting with kids and talking to them about some very challenging issues that their family had experienced and that they may have experienced. So for some of this information that we have with a young person who may be re-traumatized or in a situation where the trauma may have occurred, 10 years earlier, and now they're going through things as a young person again, or they may be coming back to the agency at age 16 and they left the agency 10 years ago. It's about that therapeutic intervention. And is there a model that we can say, because oftentimes many psychologists will even talk about, they're not going to hand somebody a psychological evaluation. They're going to sit down with them and talk them through that. So I think that there is some therapeutic stuff we need to think about rather than just handing somebody 4 inches of paper. But I think that's something we can sort out, certainly, as we look at the principle behind it. How do we want to go about doing this work? It really is about how do you empower the young person to take control and charge of their life, and they need to know where they've been and what they're going to do in the future. So we need to be able to figure out how do you empower somebody in a therapeutic, natural way of doing that and support them as they move forward. So I think we can get there.
Yeah, quick question. Yes, since case managers, and I've worked with a number of case managers, and I'd say most of them are very good. There were some bad ones that I worked with. I didn't hesitate to let people know who I didn't think was good, fortunately. But I am worried. Some case managers have a great way of assessing and writing up a face-to-face visit. And maybe case managers don't interpret a home visit the same way, or a face-to-face visit, as another would be. Do you think some case managers will be hesitant in what they may have observed in a face-to-face that, they didn't see it was healthy, but they'd be afraid to put it down in the chart because they know that the client would be able to see what the case manager wrote? I mean, I can envision certain situations where that might occur, but...
So I would like to make a clarification, again, of what is intended. I'm not imagining that this would be, and if you it talks about signing a release of information. So I've got a different bill that's about adults trying to get their child welfare records as adults. That really would be all of the materials. At that point, they're adults. They've got something else they're working on. This really is that to sign a release of information authorizing disclosure of confidential information maintained by the department for the purpose of obtaining assistance from an advocate, attorney, legislator, or any other person. So if you think back to the times that you've done DHS constituent work, you get that release of information. they're not sending you any written materials. What's happening is you're able to have a conversation with someone at the department that helps you understand what's happening with that young person or that family, so you can help that family figure out how to work their way through the process. We do a lot of DHS casework in our office, and we have rarely gotten, I don't know that we've ever gotten written materials from the department. We've gotten conversation. Sometimes we've gotten written materials from families, but generally the only way that really specific information has been when a family has invited me to come and sit in a case planning meeting. And at that point, there's yet another disclosure that gets signed around that meeting. So it may be that we need to work on the language to make clear what this is about, but it's not envisioned as all the psychological reports and all of these other things. It's more of the case is scheduled on this date. These are the general reasons why the youth is being removed from this placement that she doesn't want to be removed from. These are some of the circumstances that led to her not being able to be placed with her sibling, and this is who she should talk to. And I don't know about you, but a lot of times in doing that work, what we're really able to do is help that family ask better questions to better understand. And we don't change the outcome. We can just help them better understand how this complicated process is working for them and how they can better advocate for themselves in the process.
Would you like to answer? Okay. Chair Dembrough, Senator Moniz Anderson, we have to be, I think that's some of the things we're going to be working with Senator Gelser. We certainly want our case managers and our caseworkers to address all the needs of the child thoughtfully and in a way that it's inclusive of all others who are working on the case as well. So that's something we will discuss. And we don't want to re-traumatize children, and we don't want, we don't want to put anything in jeopardy in terms of the kind of work and kind of support we're giving them as well. So we'll work together. And I don't know if, Kevin, you have anything.
Chair Dembrough, Moniz Anderson, I guess the other pieces that I would think about really, again, as a caseworker, part of the work we've done over the last year, 2 years really, is around Child and Family Services Review, which has been the federal review that's come in, and we've done a lot of auditing on that. And there's a couple of themes that keep coming up, and one of the themes really is around documentation. Are we documentation timely and accurately? And really teaching caseworkers then how to document for all those right reasons. What kind of facts are you putting in there rather than opinions? Mm-hmm. What are you actually seeing? And so document that kind of information. And then the other theme that really is kind of woven in both these bills we've been speaking of too as well is engagement. How do you engage your relationship with a young person? How do you engage with the family to ensure that you're building a teamwork and to ensure you're building a good plan to people move forward? So how do you engage with people in your work you do day to day, and then how do you actually document that work so it's clear and concise and it's factual? That's the work we've got to be doing. And I think some of the things where we look at where can we improve, those are two elements that are kind of the root cause of some of the issues we've got in the department. I think that would really help us move forward. So your point is well taken, and I think that's how we get there, is really getting it back into the documentation, teaching people how to do that correctly.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Seeing no further questions for this panel, sounds like this, too, is going into the workshop. So for now, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 749. And our last public hearing is on Senate Bill 830. So do the three of you want to stay there?
Are
for
you
this?
Talking on 830? I'm just going to say I have no comments.
This one got added later, I think.
Okay, before you start, Senator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 830 modifies the definition of a foster parent who is a current caretaker of a specified ward of the state to include those currently caring for the ward and who has cared for the ward or ward sibling for a cumulative 12 months or cumulatively one half of the ward or sibling's life when the ward or sibling is under 2 years of age.
Okay. Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm still Sarah Gelser from Senate District 8. Last long session, we worked with Senator Stark on Senate Bill 741. Senate Bill 741 had to do with this idea of current caretaker status and when a current caretaker would have the ability to go to an adoption committee. They would not necessarily be chosen to adopt the child, but in recognition of the relationship and attachment that had been built, the adoption committee would be able to add this family into the consideration of the best fit as the adoption resource. So one of the challenges that came up after we did that is sometimes you will go through, and that was 12 consecutive months the child would be with you and you would have this current caretaker status. There have been cases even since 741 where there was went to committee. Great, everybody was a great resource, but the decision was to go with the biological family. And then after a couple of months, the biological family situation disrupted. And because that then broke the consecutive months, that family would then no longer be eligible to go to the committee, even if they had been kind of the second choice of that committee. The other place that comes up, and I've talked with caseworkers in my community about this and foster parents, is that you can have a child that's coming in and out of care over a period of time where you've got this really good relationship actually that's worked out between the biological parent and the foster parent. And a lot of times these might be abuse or drug cases where the child's with the foster family, parent is making progress, child goes back to the family goes into the crisis, the child comes back, it goes back and forth. So you could end up in a circumstance where a child had spent almost all of their life with this family and maintains that relationship with this foster family even when they're back with their biological family, but because of the consecutive months, they would not be able to be considered. So again, this doesn't, just like with 741, this doesn't give a priority to that current caretaker. It just allows that resource, when qualified and appropriate, to be considered alongside other family. And I believe it fits with that idea of keeping kids with family and kin and kith and people that they have built attachments with. So the co-sponsors on this are Representative Stark and Olson and Senator Roblin. We have the identical bill over in the House as well. Representative Stark is not feeling well today, but he can speak to this a lot more eloquently than I can, and has had a great deal of personal experience with this problem.
Okay. Well, I, you know, remember very well the discussion of 741, and I think that was a good bill. I'm glad we passed it. Senator, do you have a sense of how it's being implemented? I mean, I see that this problem has arisen, but aside from this problem, which seems like a technical fix to me, mm-hmm. just to provide more flexibility, but in general, are we seeing the current caretakers intervening in cases? And I mean, is it working the way we had hoped?
Senator Dimbro, members of the committee, I think it had a rough start. It was a controversial bill, and there are a lot of strongly held feelings about biology and adoption, and I'm an adoptive parent, so I'll put that out there. It probably informs my way of thinking about things. I think it's going better. I know Representative Stark, former Representative Buckley, and I were invited in September to Ashland, and we got to attend the adoption celebration of a little boy who was adopted by the family that took him home from the hospital and whose birth mother had identified them. That had been a contentious case that was appealed multiple times because there was a grandmother that he had not previously met in another state that also was interested, but three different committees kind of looked at the resource, looked at this child, and were able to say that he's bonded and attached. And that little guy was doing really well when we were down there. It was a pretty good day, and one of the most satisfying experiences I've had as a legislator, to see something play out in that way and how it impacted this very, very, very loved, healthy, well-adjusted, and well-attached child. His parents were pretty good, too.
Yes. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I just want to say at the moment we have no comments, but we will get you our position within the next day.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? No. Okay, thank you all.
Thank you.
Senator Gelser, thank you for your participation in this process. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 830, and I will keep the gavel here until the chair resumes her position.
You could just adjourn us.
I'm not going to do that. It's your job.
I just wanted to stay for the extra couple seconds. All right. Thank you all very much. We're adjourned. We're adjourned. All right. Thank you all very much.